evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, May 19, 2017. President Omar al-Bashir decides to skip the upcoming summit in Saudi Arabia.
Still, the situation of the president in the international community still is linked to the ICC indictment, and that is sort of an embarrassment, and you don't want to complicate things.
And South Sudan tops the list of most fragile states.
We are aware of this acute food shortage which was caused by concentration of rebel attacks that obstructed humanitarian movement, banditry activities that were also being conducted by rebels, abducting humanitarian workers, killing humanitarian workers.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's government says President Omar al-Bashir is skipping a summit that U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to attend because he does not want to upset Sudanese-American relations. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says Khartoum recognizes that Bashir's indictment by the International Criminal Court makes it difficult for him to meet the U.S. president. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
The Sudanese government says Mr. Bashir received an official invitation from King Salman ibn Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia to attend the summit in Riyadh on Sunday. The U.S. Embassy in Khartoum released an online statement on Wednesday saying it opposed invitations, facilitation, or support for travel by any person subject to outstanding International Criminal Court or ICC arrest warrants, including President Bashir. President Bashir was indicted in 2009 by the Hague-based court for alleged genocide in Darfur, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says Khartoum recognizes that it is difficult for President Bashir to meet President Trump because of his ICC indictment.
Still, the situation of the president in the international community still is linked to the ICC indictment, and that is sort of an embarrassment, and you don't want to complicate things.
Bilal says the meeting of the two men in Riyadh would have also made things difficult for Mr. Trump, who is expected to make a ruling about whether to completely lift economic sanctions imposed on Sudan by the U.S. since 1997.
If he met the president, this is, will be an extra pressure. Besides, this is, will be an opportunity for the opposition there to make some sort of problems against him. So we don't want to complicate things.
Khartoum-based political analyst Ismail Ibrahim says, as long as Mr. Bashir has outstanding arrest warrants against him, it is unlikely that he will ever meet the U.S. president.
I don't think that he can be allowed to attend the meeting presided by the President of the United States of America. Is going to open, you know, a very complicated, you know, trial. We should try not to navigate in this kind of waters or in this kind of territory now.
Ibrahim says Mr. Bashir should focus on making peace at home and putting his house in order instead of having a face-to-face meeting with President Trump.
The president should concentrate on how to bring about peace in the country, unify the so-called internal front, bring about those who have yet to join the dialogue or the peace process in the Sudan. And I hope that will ultimately lead to the lifting of sanctions that have been imposed on the Sudan completely, you know.
The Sudan government-owned news agency SONA reported today that President Omar al-Bashir has apologized to King Salman of Saudi Arabia for being unable to attend the Riyadh summit for personal reasons. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
South Sudan tops the list of most fragile states across the world, according to a U.S.-based research organization, Fund for Peace. The group says South Sudan's deepening food insecurity and the ongoing violent conflict make it the most fragile nation in the world. A government official denies South Sudan is a fragile state, but admits it faces big challenges. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
The fragile state index, now in its 13th year, assesses 178 countries based on 12 social, economic, and political factors. The Fund for Peace says a fragile state is characterized by a weak or ineffective central government that has little practical control over much of its territory, such as failure to deliver public services, widespread corruption and criminality, and involuntary movement of populations. The Fund for Peace says South Sudan tops this year's list because all of those things are happening in the country, along with the government's decision to suspend elections 2 years ago. South Sudan Deputy Information Minister Akolpol Kordit calls the report's findings unfounded and false.
Business are being conducted and transacted. Government is functioning in all the states and at the national level. The peace agreement is being implemented. In fact, the level of the scales of violence have dropped dramatically and significantly across the country. And no more major fighting. So you wonder what South Sudan is he talking about the report.
Abraham Awolich is a senior policy analyst at the Juba-based think tank, the Sud Institute. He too disagrees with the criteria the Fund for Peace uses to rank fragile states.
The tool of measuring people is biased in a sense that we are not on the same page, and therefore we cannot be evaluated on the same page. Perhaps if you were to say that a country, you know, if you were to rank us from the perspective of countries gaining independence 5 years after independence, what they have done, and now you compare us with those who have gone through similar experiences 5 years into their independence, then maybe that would be a legitimate way of ranking. South Sudan.
But Awolich says it is clear that South Sudan has big problems politically and economically.
It is not for us to deny that our country is not doing bad. We are doing very bad. We have war at hand. We have people displaced. We have violence everywhere, and people are dying from poverty and also from famine. Those things are not deniable.
Last year, Somalia topped the list of most fragile states. Somalia still faces ongoing challenges with insecurity, poverty, and state legitimacy. On Wednesday, 5 security personnel and a mine expert were killed in Somalia's capital when a car bomb exploded as they tried to defuse it. On Saturday, residents said at least 6 people were killed and 9 others injured when rival clan militias clashed in central Somalia. The country's ranking improved slightly due to a drop in battle-related deaths in the ongoing conflict with the Al-Shabaab militants. Other countries in the Fund for Peace 2017 Very High Alert category include the Central African Republic, Yemen, Syria, and Sudan. Kordit says while he believes South Sudan does not fit into the category of most fragile states, he acknowledges that ongoing fighting causes hunger but blames rebel fighters for the suffering across the country.
We are aware of this acute food shortage which was caused by concentration of rebel attacks that obstructed humanitarian movement, the banditry activities that were also being conducted by rebels, abducting humanitarian workers, killing humanitarian workers, looting food, which prevented this local population from accessing humanitarian assistance. But I think this has been addressed now.
Kordit denies that thousands of South Sudanese continue to flee the country because of the continuing violence and food insecurity. The United Nations says South Sudan is now the leading country in Africa with the highest number of refugees in neighboring countries, including Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya. Last week, the French medical organization MSF reported that 20,000 South Sudanese civilians were heading to Sudan as refugees because of continuing conflict and a lack of basic necessities such as food or clean water. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A United Nations joint report published today documents abuses carried out by both government and opposition forces against civilians in and around Yei State, between July 2016 and January 2017. The report compiled by the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, and the UN Human Rights Office documents abuses that include indiscriminate shelling of civilians, targeted killings, and looting and burning of civilian property. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
The report says it has documented evidence that pro-government forces killed 114 people and wounded dozens of others suspected of being rebel supporters in and around Yei. Eugene Nindorera, director of the Human Rights Division at UNMISS, says it is important to highlight the atrocities committed against civilians so that those responsible can be brought to justice.
Even right now, the situation in Yei is still alarming, and it is really important to make sure that civilians can walk alone, there be a safe place. And it's also important, according to us, as a recommendation, to make sure that we can get to a ceasefire as soon as possible. And secondly, make sure that those who have committed those atrocities, each or whatever side they are, could be held accountable.
Nindorera says, while gathering evidence of crimes committed in Yei alone, the report's authors realized human rights violations against civilians had occurred in many parts of the country.
Unfortunately, there were some even increase of places where human rights violations are occurring right now. But whatever human rights violations are being committed, they are really going to be addressed, and those who are responsible for those violations have to be held accountable.
Government forces sexually abused or raped many women and young girls, including those who were fleeing violence in their villages and trying to make their way to neighboring Uganda or the Democratic Republic of Congo. SPLA Deputy Spokesperson in Juba, Santo Domich, calls the report biased, saying the information was prepared by individuals who are trying to tarnish the image of the SPLA.
These are all biased information and misleading. UNMISS, as per se, has a role to play in maintaining the security in this country or in protection of the civil population. So what were their role when what they were actually seeing those things happening, you know, before their eyes, you know, then if they cannot do anything, then this thing is bad.
Domich says the army has a clear relationship with the civilians outlined in the SPLA Act. He says crimes possibly committed by individual soldiers, which he refers to as mistakes, should not be generalized on the entire South Sudanese Army.
So sometimes you see the international community or maybe some agencies in Kilimanjaro just go in and give a blanket accusation. Even if it is one person who has committed a mistake or committed anything, then to say that it is the SPLA.
The level of abuses committed by armed opposition groups remains unclear due to a lack of access to areas where such groups are active, according to the report. SPLA in opposition military spokesperson Paul Lam Gabriel says he welcomed the report but did not admit that opposition forces committed abuses. Lam says government allied militia operating in and around Yei abuse civilians who were masked as rebel fighters.
These militias is counter-insurgency trick that is being used by the government to make sure they spoil the image of the HPLA because they're the youth from the area. So they go and do all kind of havoc. Then we are blamed for that. That government and the militias doing that.
The report says the information gathered is a result of face-to-face interviews with eyewitnesses and victims who testified about abuses they saw or experienced. Satellite imagery used to corroborate allegations showed widespread burning of houses and business took place, resulting into the forcibly displacement of tens of thousands of civilians. The report says the conflict and abuses committed in and around Yei highlight the level of impunity that exists in South Sudan as civilians continue to be subjected to successive cycles of violence across the country. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Coming up, we take a look at efforts made to combat the spread of tuberculosis in South Sudan and other African countries. That report is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who is your favorite relative and why?
Yeah, my favorite relative, the youngest kid in my family, she's the most close to me because she's so fun and she's intelligent. I like the way she converses, the conversation, you know. That's why I like her the most.
My favorite relative, I think I should say my mom. Yeah, because I'm so open to her. We talk. Apart from my mom. Oh my God, that's so hard. My grandma, my grandmother. She has been there for me since my mom. Like, my mom is around, but my mom is not always around. So my grandma, she's always there for me.
My favorite relatives, my immediate sisters, they always give me courage, show me the reality in what I'm doing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The French medical organization Médecins Sans Frontières is calling on the G20 health ministers meeting this week to support efforts to develop new affordable tuberculosis treatment that can cure all forms of the disease in less than a month. Sharon Ann Lynch, MSF HIV and TB policy advisor, tells Ayen Bior that G20 leaders have backtracked on their commitment to deliver to develop effective medicine and vaccines to counter drug-resistance infections.
This is the first time that the G20 is taking on a health issue, and they have all of the power and all of the capability, frankly, to stop a disease like TB in its tracks, because essentially it's the mix of countries that are affected. Because TB does not limit itself to only the very poorest countries.
The press release states that MSF is concerned that G20 states are backtracking on its commitment regarding antimicrobial resistance and tuberculosis as well. That's a very strong statement.
It is. But here's the fact of the matter is, you know, there have been promises before to confront antimicrobial resistance, and especially in terms of TB. And yet we let R&D languish. There is a yawning research and development funding gap. And frankly, because of the market failure, because essentially pharmaceutical companies don't see the profit in terms of producing new TB drugs, we haven't had any new TB drugs for 40 years.
What can countries, particularly developing countries, do to stop its spread?
So developing countries have at their disposal a few tools that can help. One, there's rapid molecular testing that can provide a result for TB in short order. And this is an innovation over the previous test where, you know, people would look for TB under a microscope. So it's a great advancement. And that test, especially in high-burden countries, should be at every district level, to tell you the truth. However, the fact of the matter is that we are failing. We are failing over the last 4 years to increase the number of people who are tested, which remains about 6 million people out of the 10 million people who newly develop TB each year. So as a result, we've got almost 2 million needless deaths just from TB every year. And for a curable disease, it's just not acceptable.
That's MSF's TB and HIV policy advisor Sharon Ann speaking to Ayen Bior from New York. There are now 29 suspected cases of Ebola in remote Northern Democratic Republic of Congo. The World Health Organization updated the figure today, reflecting an increase of 9 since yesterday. The figure also includes 2 laboratory-confirmed deaths of Ebola. The World Health Organization says it probably won't know for several weeks what the full extent of the outbreak is. World Health officials are trying to find more than 400 people who may have come in contact with those who are infected. One of the researchers who discovered Ebola virus in 1976 and helped name it after an African is following developments in the DRC. Dr. Malunga Matudila is currently a consultant since retiring from the World Bank in 2005. He spoke to VOA's Jordi Kapwa about the DRC outbreak.
My first reaction is that this is something we should expect, although we don't know when and where the next blow will come, because unfortunately we have to live with the Ebola virus, because Ebola is in our African forest across the equator. So Congo being the largest country in that area, so we should expect DRC to be hit more often than the other countries.
Are we encountering Ebola reservoirs in gorillas or chimpanzees or bats? Do we know?
Yes. What we think we have discovered is that the virus live in good term with some bats. And then, accidentally, we come in contact with those bats, because in this area, unfortunately, people seem to love bat meat. This is how the infection gets into the human community. Sometimes the infection is indirect, because maybe another animal has been infected by the bats, like antelopes, when they eat droppings from bats, or sometimes monkeys, because monkeys, they do eat bats, so they get infected.
Now, you've talked about encroaching into areas we have not encroached before, and Ebola is one of the results from that. Do you see other diseases or viruses emerging that we have not seen before?
In the African forest, you know that we have thousands of species, both vegetal and animal, that are not known yet. So we should be expecting to encounter new friends.
Having seen what happened in West Africa just a few years ago, what lessons were learned that can be applied to the outbreak in the northern DRC?
What happened in West Africa last time? First, denial. They thought that they were living outside the Ebola area. And second, when they were forced to admit the existence of Ebola, the response was very, very, very slow. It took them more than 6 months to start responding to the outbreak. And third mistake, they thought that Ebola was a medical problem, a problem to be tackled by experts from outside. So they will ask people not to do anything, but to just wait for them to come, these experts. So these three mistakes explain why in West Africa Ebola could survive more than 12 months and kill more people. And now we are afraid, because this is the first time where Ebola had the opportunity to pass through many, 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 many patients. So that means Ebola has learned how to defend itself against a human being. So maybe in West Africa now we are dealing with an improved virus or more efficient virus.
Doctor, would you like to add anything more about the outbreak in the DRC?
Since 1976 up to today, Ebola has killed 953 people in DRC. Very, very little compared to the number of deaths due to malaria. Yes, we have to fight Ebola, so we have very simple technology to control Ebola. So please, we should not be distracted from malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, diarrheal diseases, and things like that.
That's Dr. Malunga Miatidula, one of the researchers who discovered the Ebola virus in 1976. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. A succession of brutal murders of women and children in South Africa has sparked a national outrage and calls for action to end persistent violence. Tuso Kumalo has the story from Johannesburg.
We, as the citizens of this country, we must say enough is enough. This cannot be accepted. The police, they must double their effort. I don't know whether we need to introduce more harsher laws or change the laws. This, I think, we must discuss.
Yes.
It's a crisis in the country.
That is South African President Jacob Zuma speaking Thursday at a service for three-year-old Courtney Peters of Cape Town. A man has been charged with her rape and murder. South Africa has long had high levels of rape and murder, but a rash of crimes in recent weeks has grabbed national attention. Well-known South African men are calling on men to stand up. Actor Patrick Shai.
When are we as going to take our position in society, in families, and come to the defense of our women and children? When is that? How many carabos must be there before you stand up as a man and say, it cannot happen in my name?
Karabo's death was followed by gruesome killings of four other women also in Soweto, the southwestern suburb of Johannesburg. Two of the women were friends. Three suspects have been arrested in connection with their case. The other two cases are being investigated separately. The youngest victim, Nombuyiselo Nombewu, was 15 years old. Her aunt, Vuyelwa Nombewu, says she cannot understand why someone would do this. She says there is a lot that we expected from Nombuyiselo. We never thought her life would end this way. The crimes of aggravated murder and rape in South Africa result in 25-year sentence. While President Zuma says harsher penalties may be needed, activists say police are not aggressively enforcing the existing laws. Police Minister Fikile Mbalula accepts the criticism.
Some cases have been reported, including to the police. Not enough action have been taken. Now is the time to amplify and to speak to those who passed on and those who are still alive.
Cheryl Chabang of the Pink Ladies Organization, a group in South Africa that helps trace missing children and family members, says it is important that education starts young.
It's high time we taught a boy child what it means to respect a woman. We are living in societies that are broken. Most of these boys who end up being abusive are growing up watching the abuse happening at home.
One in five women in South Africa experience violence at the hands of a partner, according to a study released last week. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
That sad story by Tuso Kumalo brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Vitaimana by Congolese musician Fer Gola.
Ça, c'est le tube qui vous fait toujours plaisir. Fer et cher de Paul Gola. Voilà comment je suis devenu. Mokonzinanga Ginoel Ngoya. Gilwemba ya Métiol. Junior Aziz. Jacques Mayito.
Salem service, comme il parle, voyez. Comme il est son voyez. Nasimbi batouche potinga na linga kayo mingi na komi kobeta batuluka matina kartye na bino ba master kartye ba komi kotongo ngai na masolo soki na leki eba lobaka leki edit kilanda moko mawa na leki
presta peki
na leki mawa ake kotala Salem na baye. Pourquoi n'y a son ayaka na kuta kananga kaka yete?
Corps coordinateur,
balobinga na tinga mayon pona bongo. Balobinga na tinga mayon pona bongo Salem. Lobeno konina ngosio somela ma kome souvenir.
Mav ma vinga.
Kolia na liaka senga imoko. Kolata pena la taka senga imoko. Soki jifeminia teba mastato alita chamala nani mosusu pozoki simote manangai papa ponini obebi sinzotongo
shiro chamala
pona maloba ya kinsasa Jean-Jacques Mutuale pona songi songi ya kini wayo tonino Fernando mamani
passe lengi Jamila Tiro Pierrot Leblanc Mav Mavinga Chiba Chibasu Trésor Ngando Dajou Mbombasi
Salem service garçon à Paris Yomoto la qui soit cliqué poli moyaye
Montana Kabumbaye
Yomoto la qui soit cliqué poli moyaye
Serge Pachotti
Capri Segula bébé à papa Yomoto la qui soit cliqué poli moyaye
Jacques Mayito Mathieu Bichirira
Washington est grand pays au bébé si bolingo et comme il en colande moya makolo imana na vita
Jojo Abiba
Bilimana Mazembe Sanga Balende Lipopo
Bébé Bambale Chiquito Lila
We have been listening to Fer Gola with the song Vita Imana. I am John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Have a peaceful weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mm-hmm. Tete Samurai, Blanchard Kilombo.